On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, it's my pleasure to welcome all of you to today's Internet-based training on environmental management at operating outdoor small arms firing ranges. My name is Mary Yelkin. I will be serving as your moderator today, and I'm coming to you from Lincoln, Nebraska. As with all of ITRC's Internet-based training courses, we are offering them in conjunction with EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation, and they host the CLUIN website that you are participating on today. So we very much appreciate that continued relationship with EPA. Today's training is based off a technical and regulatory guidance document that was developed by ITRC's Small Arms Firing Range team and just published early this year. And you'll see the guidance listed on this screen. You can download that in our links pages at the conclusion of today's training course if you haven't already done so, because certainly in a couple hours we can give you quite a bit of information, but to give you more detail and a more full understanding of the topic, we really suggest that you download that guidance document. Today's training teaches students on that environmental management planning at small arms firing ranges is a method for pollution prevention. The training uses a logic diagram to describe appropriate steps an environmental professional or range manager would use to establish an operational understanding of the range and the impact it can have on the environment if left unattended. This team also, in 2003, developed a training and associated guidance that focuses on characterization and remediation of soils at closed small arms firing ranges. So if you're interested or working with any closed small arms firing ranges, we would also encourage you to download that guidance document, and there is also an associated internet-based training with that course as well. For those of you just joining us, welcome. We very much appreciate you taking your time out of your busy schedules to be with us today. Just a few logistical reminders for those of you that have just come on the phone lines. We ask that you please keep your phones on mute to eliminate background noise. If you do not have a mute function on your phone, please press *6 to mute your phone, and *7 remove that function if you'd like to ask a question during the two designated question and answer periods. Certainly those of you on phone lines will have an opportunity to ask your questions verbally. Those of you that are on simulcast hearing the audio through your computer speakers, you will be able to have an opportunity to type in your questions and submit those to me as the moderator. And then once you do that, you will be able to hear me verbally ask your question, and you will be able to hear the instructor's verbal response. Now, you'll notice that there's a series of orange buttons at the top of each slide. And the single arrow to the right will advance you one slide forward. The single arrow to the left will take you one slide back. The double arrows take you either to the beginning or ending of the presentation. And the home symbol will return you back to the page that had the presentation overview as well as pictures and bios of the instructors. Now, the question mark button is that button that I just referred to that allows simulcast users to ask questions, but can be used by anyone at any time during today's training course. The computer disk symbol allows you to download today's training, which does include some additional speaker's notes in the notes pages, but because it's a fairly large file, I would suggest that you wait and do that until we get to the links page at the conclusion of today's training course. Let's go ahead now and move over to slide number 2 by clicking on the single arrow to the right. And certainly we know many of you are frequent participants of ITRC training courses, so if you have been to our courses before, welcome back. If this is your first course, we very much appreciate you taking this opportunity that ITRC is giving you to attend this training course, and we want to give you a little bit more information about ITRC. We are a state-led organization working in conjunction with the broader environmental community to provide tools and resources to help people make better decisions when they're considering using innovative technologies or approaches. ITRC is hosted by the Environmental Council of States, and each state that is an official member of ITRC must designate a state point of contact within their environmental or equivalent agency. And you can see on the map the states colored in green are those states that have identified a specific state point of contact. If you'd like to find out who your state point of contact is, that information is available on the ITRC website. We enjoy the sponsorship and partnership of our federal partners, including Department of Energy, Department of Defense, and the Environmental Protection Agency. But not only do we work with governmental agencies, we also work with a broad range of sectors within the environmental community. We typically work in technical teams that are state-led, and then the membership of those teams include additional state regulators, people from federal agencies, industry consultants, academia, community, and tribal stakeholders. These teams typically develop guidance documents and associated training courses that provide decision-making tools. Certainly, our main focus is on state regulators, but we also hope that many others in the environmental community will take advantage of these tools as well. Moving on to slide number 3, this is a list of courses we are offering through the Internet-based program in 2005. We're offering several that were developed in past years because they continue to be very popular. We also have several new courses we're offering for the first time in 2005. So as I said, at the end of today's training, we will take you to a link where you can access more information about our training courses. Moving on to slide number 4, for those of you that have just joined us, please review the logistical reminders on the right-hand side of the screen. For this course, it's about 2.25 hours. On the left-hand side, there's a basic presentation overview where we will start with some introductory material to make sure everybody has a common understanding of some of the terms that will be used today and talk about some of the basics of range management. We'll take a break for questions and answers and then get into some more specific environmental issues, best management practices, and then we'll take that second break for questions and answers, take you to links to additional resources, and give you an opportunity to give us some feedback on how the training went for you today. On slide number 5, it's my pleasure to introduce our instructors for today. All of them are members of ITRC Small Arms Firing Range team. First, we'll be hearing from Elizabeth Callahan, and she comes to us from Boston, Massachusetts, where she is an environmental analyst with the Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection. She currently coordinates the Massachusetts Lead Shot Initiative, which is a partnership with shooting sports community and provides assistance to private and public range managers with implementing best management practices. We will then hear from Mark Begley, and he is the Executive Director of the Massachusetts Environmental Management Commission at Camp Edwards on the Massachusetts Military Reservation. And there he is responsible for assuring that the military training camp at Camp Edwards is in compliance with environmental protection standards. We will then hear from Bonnie Packer. She is from Aberdeen Proving Ground in Maryland and has been working as a contractor with the U.S. Army Environmental Center since 1996, where she supports their acquisition and technology division, and she currently manages several projects for the government, anything from corrosion of unexploded ordnance on soil environments to munitions residue assessments and many others involving small arms range assessments. We will then hear from Mike Morminski. He comes to us from Somerset, New Jersey, and he is with AMIC Earth and Environmental, where he is a technical director and a range program manager. He has over 23 years experience in civil engineering, remediation, and construction, and he has extensive experience in identifying, developing, and managing multidisciplinary range projects for the Department of Defense as well as law enforcement facilities. So we're very pleased to have these experts as members of ITRC's Small Arms Firing Range team. Let's go ahead and move on to slide number 6, and at this point it's my pleasure to turn it over to Elizabeth Callahan with the state of Massachusetts. Elizabeth?
Thank you, Mary. Am I on?
Yes, you are.
Okay, thank you. I'd like to begin by first talking about some terms we'll be using, and the first of which is defining what we mean by operating outdoor small arms firing range. We're referring to ranges that include military as well as public safety, privately and publicly owned ranges, commercial and recreational ranges that include rifle and pistol as well as shotgun ranges, trap, sporting clays, and skeet ranges. Small arms firing ranges are ranges that use ammunition 50 caliber or less, non-exploding ammunition. And in the United States, this encompasses more than 3,000 ranges that are managed by the Department of Defense, as well as an additional estimated 9,000 non-military small arms ranges, recreational and public safety. Slide 7, please. I also want to make a key distinction right at the beginning that our focus is on the management of active ranges, as opposed to the remediation of closed ranges. And as Mary mentioned, ITRC has developed a guidance document on the closure of ranges and remediating those ranges to make them suitable for some other future use. And that guidance was developed in 2003 and is the characterization and remediation of soils at closed small arms firing ranges. Today's focus is on the management of active ranges and managing the environment in a way to minimize the impact of shooting activities at those ranges. And there is a supporting guidance document that was published in January of this year titled The Environmental Management at Operating Outdoor Small Arms Firing Ranges. The two topics do have some overlap in terms of delineating where the impacts are at the range. So some of the issues are the same, but we want to make the distinction that we're going to be focusing today on what it takes to keep an operating range in good environmental condition. Slide 8, please. The key concern with environmental management of small arms ranges is lead and other metals that are present at the range. Lead is a primary material or contaminant of concern at the range, and if left unmanaged, it can be transported into the environment. So in its metallic form, it's relatively inert, but if it's not managed at the range, it can make its way into the soil and into other environmental media. Another focus of the training is our ranges. Some ranges were sited at a time when people didn't understand the potential issues related to lead in the environment, and they discharged directly into surface water bodies and wetlands. So we'll be looking also at ways to manage that as an issue at ranges. Slide 9, please. What we're hoping you'll learn today is first an understanding of the basic environmental stewardship principles or the goals of range management. We'll also talk about the various elements of environmental management planning. Mike Warminski will take us through the various technologies and operating practices that can be put into place to manage lead and other materials at the range, the various best management practices alternatives. And then finally, we'll address what it means to actually put a written environmental management plan together and implement it and monitor the implementation of the plan. Slide 10, please. We wanted to point out that the environmental management approach for active ranges is an approach that has a wide base of support among many different groups. There are several states, including Massachusetts, where I work with the regulatory agency, that support an approach of environmental management at active ranges and have programs in place to encourage the use of best management practices at public and private ranges. The military also has plans in place in terms of implementing environmental management systems at their facilities. This approach is also one that's supported by the shooting sports community and the sporting arms and ammunition manufacturers, as well as the National Shooting Sports Foundation, National Rifle Association. The industry was one of the first supporters of this approach and put together the first guidance document on environmental stewardship back in 1997. And the Federal Environmental Protection Agency as well has done work on this issue and also has a guidance document that they published in 2001. Both the National Shooting Sports Foundation guidance as well as the EPA guidance have formed a basis for the work we did in developing the ITRC guidance document. We've built that foundation in developing an approach that all of these different groups support as practical guidance. Slide 11, please. And similarly, the composition of the ITRC work group that put together the guidance document and is supporting today's training is made up of these same groups of people. We have representatives from the Department of Defense. Bonnie Packer, one of the instructors today, has served on the work group representing the military. We also have a group of consultants that do work in this area, both in terms of implementing best management practices as well as the cleanup of ranges. And Mike Warminski's among that group, as well as several states and industry, EPA, et cetera. It's a very diverse group, and I think the makeup of the group has really contributed to the quality and the practicality of the guidance document. Slide 12, please. This slide shows a flow diagram, which we'll revisit a couple of times during the training today. It really lays out the step that a range manager goes through in terms of approaching issues at the range, identifying them, and implementing, selecting best management practices and implementing a plan. This is also reflects the sequence of these topics in the guidance document. Slide 13, please. The first step in that flow diagram is to establish and come to understand what we mean by the principles of environmental stewardship. And those are basically the objectives of environmental management planning at an active range. They include employing practical means to minimize the impact of range activities on human health and the environment, to protect your natural resources at the range, protect groundwater quality, surface water, wetlands environment, wildlife and wildlife habitat, to prevent erosion, to the extent that you can limit the impact of the range and prevent erosion, you can limit the size of the problem that you need to manage at the range. So Bonnie is going to talk more about erosion as an issue at the range, and we'll talk later about management practices to limit erosion. And sound management, although this is not strictly an environmental issue, many state and local governments have rules about controlling noise, and to the extent a range manager can reduce or limit sound, he or she can improve the range's relationship with his neighbor. So such efforts are evidence of environmental stewardship or being a good neighbor. Slide 14, please. In terms of the regulatory perspective and where active ranges fit with respect to environmental regulations, management of ranges, environmental issues at ranges, is really a pollution prevention program. And to the extent that the range manager is successful at managing the range, they can hopefully avoid having to deal with issues related to other environmental regulations, keep them from coming into play. Often when people talk about regulatory issues with respect to ranges, they talk about the Resource Conservation Recovery Act, which deals with the management of solid and hazardous waste and its applicability. And the Environmental Protection Agency document on range management does a good job summarizing the applicability of RCRA. And that document talks about lead at the time it is discharged at a range is not considered a hazardous waste because it's being used for its intended purpose. Once discharged, however, and left unmanaged in the environment, lead may be deemed at some point to be abandoned. And at that point, it could become subject to RCRA, could be considered a hazardous waste. So therefore, the focus of environmental management planning and environmental management at the range is to keep lead from being considered unmanaged or abandoned. The other important issue with respect to RCRA and its applicability in terms of implementation of best management practices is that lead that is recovered and recycled at a range can be treated as a scrap metal, and that has implications for the costs of managing it. And Mike will talk more about that later. Slide 15, please. Other federal environmental laws and state laws may also be applied to ranges. In the instance I mentioned earlier about ranges that discharge directly into surface water bodies, those could be subject to the Clean Water Act for those surface water discharges. Many states also have separate wetlands protection laws that prohibit or limit activities within wetlands, and they've been applied to ranges that shoot directly into wetlands or are filling wetlands with projectiles or targets. And also, if a range is having an off-range impact, and there's some concern for public health or environmental risks, those impacts could also be subject to the cleanup laws under federal or state Superfund-type laws. In terms of the focus of the ITRC guidance document, we've taken the position that successful environmental management that's effective and adequate will help to ensure that a range does not become subject to, that leaded range is not considered abandoned and thus subject to being viewed as hazardous waste at the range. And a range that is effective in its environmental management planning should be operating in compliance with federal and state environmental laws. Slide 16, please. This table appears in the guidance document. It appears in the first ITRC guidance document as well. It lists the primary potential contaminants at the range. And the principal contaminant of concern, as I mentioned, is lead. It's the primary constituent of lead shot and lead bullets. There are also other metals that may be present at the range that may be part of alloys used in the projectiles or other components. And as well as in the case of shotgun sports, you may find polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, organic compound that's present in the limestone matrix of the clay targets at shotgun ranges. So if you're approaching a range and the management of materials that are there as a result of shooting activities, this is a list of things you may be looking for. Lead, obviously, you'll be finding there. But really, the place to start is to try to get a good accounting of how the range has been used in the past and currently what type of ammunition has been used there, so you have a list of the potential contaminants you'll be dealing with at the range. Slide 17, please. Another initial step in terms of environmental management planning is to conduct a baseline assessment of range conditions. And we like to stress that this is a range-specific evaluation. This must be done in every case where you actually get out and walk the range and account for various issues at the range because each range is different and requires a specific evaluation of those conditions. The evaluation of the baseline range conditions will then be used to look and see what progress is being made when you actually get to the point where you're implementing best management practices. So this is a necessary first step. And the evaluation includes looking at the initial distribution of the projectiles and other materials that are at the range because of shooting activities. And Mark Begley will talk more about where you can expect to find lead and other materials at the range. And then looking at the fate and transport, are there any pathways for transport, any type of transport occurring at the range? And is there any potential for exposure to either people or wildlife in and around the range environment? Slide 18, please. This slide lists some of the pieces of information that you pull together that are relevant to this baseline evaluation. You'll be looking at information related to the local geology, the soil types, because different soil types have different characteristics in terms of potential mobility of lead and other metals at the range. The vegetation, is it thickly vegetated or are there areas that are not vegetated? And what does that mean in terms of erosion, topography, the slope of the range, the surface water hydrology, are there streams on the site, ponds, and how are the ranges oriented with respect to these areas? Wetlands, as I mentioned, water quality, historical and current use, the amount of use, and how many years has the range been used? Because when you start to calculate the amount of lead that's used at a range, it quickly adds up over the number of years of use. And basically the site layout, what are your property boundaries? Do you know where your property boundaries are? There are many cases where property boundaries can be an issue and ranges are even shooting beyond their property boundaries. Target locations, the distribution of the shot or bullets, and one of the resources that we use in particular in Massachusetts is shown in the photograph there, aerial photographs where you can overlay the distribution of the shot. That photograph there shows a trap and skeet range, and the dark areas in the aerial photograph are wetlands and surface water areas. So this is an example of how that information is a good place to start in terms of defining what potential issues you have. And at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Mark Begley, who's going to talk in much more detail about determining where the shot and bullets are at the range.
Okay, Liz, can you hear me?
I can.
Okay. Thank you, Liz. Just want to reemphasize what Liz mentioned a moment ago with it. You know, looking at the range layout is a key aspect in figuring out where materials may be transported ultimately, and also the ammunition used. And that's what I'm going to be focusing on in this next section. The more you understand your range, the more you can understand how it may interact with the environment. And as Liz pointed out also, it is very site-specific. Each range can be very different, as I hope to point out. Okay, next slide, slide 20, please. Shot and bullet distribution. We're going to go over a number of factors at the various ranges and how it affects the distribution of the projectiles. Everything from where it is located, its design, the firearms that are used, the ammunition used, how they're used, all influence the ultimate location of where the metals can end up in the environment. In the top photo, we have some soldiers firing from a laying down position. There's no backstop behind those targets. And so because of the angle that they're shooting at, it's significantly different bullet impact area from where the bullets would be landing if they had been standing. They'd be hitting the ground much closer. And obviously if there was an effective berm or mound of soil behind those targets, the bullets would end up hundreds of yards closer than they would at this military range. In the lower picture, you see a picture from the Olympics in Greece recently in which there was a fabric-covered berm, and that significantly changed where the shotgun pellets would have ultimately landed had that range not had some kind of a berm or a hillside, a natural hillside, or a shot curtain, and we'll go into what some of those terms are in subsequent slides. Next slide, please, slide 21. This is a picture of a typical rifle or pistol range, and static range refers to the fact that the shooters are not moving, they're staying still and firing at a target that is also not moving. And in an idealized world, they would be shooting at those targets, and right behind the bullseye, you would be having a significant bullet pocket develop because their shots were all going in the same location. The problem is if you did have something like that occur, you would also have ultimately a ricochet problem starting to develop as the bullets start hitting each other in the berm if it wasn't properly managed, and have secondary locations where the materials would end up. You also sometimes have on the berm itself something that's referred to kind of as a tiddlywink situation in which the bullets will hit each other and start heading over the backside of the berm. And where that arrow is pointing to the safety fan, you oftentimes have a lot of projectiles there, not because they went through the berm, but because they just literally bounced over to the back of it. The area immediately in front of the shooters that's labeled as the range floor in this graphic is also an area where you can oftentimes have fine metal particles ending up in the soil, partly from the effect of the rifling in the rifle or pistol wearing on the surface of the projectile as it's leaving the firearm or from residue from the powder or the primer that's burned as the gun is fired. At a dynamic or a tactical range, you can have situations where either the targets are moving, and I'll show you some examples of that in future slides, or you may have a situation where the shooters are moving down towards the target and changing their angles of attack and greatly changing, therefore, where the bullets would ultimately end up. Oftentimes, there's a surface danger zone map or bullet distribution map that's established for a range like this, similar to the graphic that Liz showed you earlier with that overlay for the two shotgun ranges at the site in Massachusetts that she was illustrating. At the bottom of this page, you also have reference to the lateral berm not shown. What that's referring to is at many ranges there are also side berms that are intended to try and collect or stop ricochets from going off range. Next slide, slide 22, please. The picture on the left is of a pop-up target, a moving target at a military range, taken in the wintertime, obviously. And it shows that the berm, in this case, is not behind the target. It's actually in front of the target. The berm is intended to protect the mechanism that causes the target to stand up or fall down when it's hit. And so you can have any number of arrangements of where berms are located, lateral, behind targets, in front of targets, or all of the above. On the photo on the right-hand side of the slide, there are pictures of bullets from handguns, and as you can see, they're generally still in fairly good shape. They've hit a sand pocket and distorted the front, but unlike if it was a rifle that had fired a projectile at a very high speed, it would likely have lots of smearing of the metals against either the sand particles, or if it was like a bony gravel, you'd have lots of fragmentation and you would end up with no particles that were nearly the size of these bullets that are somewhat intact. And the greater you have fragmentation and smearing on the surfaces of rocks and sand, the greater you're going to have a surface area that's open to rain coming in contact with it and perhaps taking metals down towards the groundwater, or at least additional oxidation or chemical reactions going on with the greater surface area. Next slide, please, slide 23. In this slide, you have a couple of graphics from military ranges. In the picture on the left, you have a 25-meter range, and the likely distribution of a bullet that's fired only 25 meters from the shooter is a much smaller area than you're likely to have, for instance, at a rifle range in which the target may be out 300 meters or more. And a lot of times there's various movement of the targets over time. Just because the picture, for instance, on the right-hand side shows a couple of targets that are in a location today doesn't mean that they were not somewhere else a number of years ago. And if you're doing an assessment of where the projectiles are ending up, you have to also consider, were there additional targets at some point in the past? Have the targets been moved over time? Is the current location where they've always been? All those kinds of questions are important to ask when you're trying to evaluate what kind of work should be done in the future to minimize, for instance, any lead from becoming mobile at a site. If you're just dealing with a pocket that was recently fired, you might be missing a larger pocket of bullets or other materials that were fired a number of years before, but it's still part of the active range. Next slide, slide 24, please. On the pistol ranges, depending on the number of targets you have, you could have, for instance, on the right-hand side, a number of targets that are currently used, but they are switching back and forth between, say, military use on one day and public safety folks coming in, say, the local police department or other public safety officials coming in and deciding to set up their own targets different from what the military was using at their range, and therefore you have to factor in what additional uses may have gone on. Did somebody on a weekend set up a clay target thrower and you have shotgun shells littering the range, which doesn't make sense if it's a rifle and pistol range. You have to factor in all of these items as you're looking at what kind of environmental factors are you dealing with. Also, you could have two ranges that are, because they're following specific military guidance on how to build a range, you could have two ranges in two different parts of the country that look identical on the surface, but in one case you may have groundwater 100 feet below the surface, the other place you may have it 3 feet below the surface. And as Bonnie will get into, there can be significant different ramifications from having two very different environmental factors like that. Again, a rod and gun club could have a recreational range that they normally fire one type of ammunition, but again, because of either public safety or other users, there could be a lot of different ammunition use that people would not keep track of. And if you're trying to assess what materials may be out there, you really need to know what ammunition has been used in the past and trying to keep track of that and asking to keep records of where materials were used is an important factor. Next slide, slide 25, please. These are two pictures of two rifle ranges, two military rifle ranges, two outdoor military rifle ranges. But in these pictures, as it illustrates, they look extremely different. In the picture on the left, you have a range that is fully baffled. You have sidewalls, but it is an outdoor range. As you can see, the sun coming in from the overhead. It also has a bullet trap. The bullet trap has a conveyor belt behind it that moves all of the projectiles down into a drum that the materials are recycled. The picture on the right, other than seeing the top of a pop-up target behind the berm, it's hard to notice that it is a rifle range. And again, the two military ranges that are very, very different. The only thing they really have in common that I've been able to see is neither of them use lead ammunition currently. But again, both of these ranges could have very, very different environmental impacts. One has no collection system of any kind. One has a total collection system. And you can have every kind of combination of factors in the middle between these two and still be an outdoor military rifle range. Next slide, slide 26, please. Okay, let's switch to shotgun ammunition. We've talked about rifles and pistols. Let's talk about shotguns for a moment. The picture in the top left-hand portion of the slide is a picture of a box of shot shells. The information that's normally found on a box like that, if you can see in the top left-hand corner, it says 12-gauge ammunition, 7.5 shot, which the 7.5 refers to the size of the pellets. It also mentions the number of ounces of shot, for instance, 1/8, and that may vary between 1 ounce to 1 3/4 ounces for a larger magnum shot. Also within the shot shell, which those red colored plastic tops, those are the tops of the shot shells. Within that shell is a cup that's called a wad that normally holds the shotgun pellets. And the picture to the top right is a picture of a plastic wad, normally made of polyethylene, that again holds the pellets as they are fired out of the gun, and then that drops shortly after it's fired. The size difference can be somewhat dramatic as far as the variation in shot size that you can buy for various ammunition. Those four slugs in the bottom right-hand picture are from four different shotgun shells. Those are copper slugs. They could have easily been lead slugs. That it's just one solid mass of metal with not a lot of surface area versus the picture on the left bottom. You have a number of what's probably number 9 shot that has much greater surface area because you're dealing with somewhere around 600 pellets normally fired from one shotgun shell when it's that small, again, versus the one single slug coming out from the larger size ammunition. And the smallest that you normally would find, in fact, is rare to run into it, is a number 12 shot, in which there's 2,300 pellets within a single shot shell. Okay, next slide, please, slide 27. This graphic probably would be a better graphic if it showed kind of a small metallic cloud coming out of the barrel of the gun rather than an individual bullet streaking towards the play target. The shotgun ammunition, again, will vary, and depending on what kind of ammunition is used, the distance it will travel will vary, and I'll get to that in a moment. But one of the important things, as Liz mentioned earlier, is where does that dispersed ammunition end up? The bottom of the picture here says dispersed metal shot in surface soil. I think that's more of an idealized situation. A lot of times, unfortunately, especially in certain parts of the country, it could easily have said dispersed metal shot in surficial sediments. Again, there's a big difference in what the impact could be if a shot zone or a drop zone has an area that's properly managed that is not attractive to wildlife, versus an area where in spring and fall migrations of waterfowl, for instance, the waterfowl could be feeding in shallow wetlands habitats and consuming the lead shot, which is well known to be fatal to the waterfowl. Bonnie will also be covering in her section more about the information of how not to have areas attractive to wildlife and the potential implications of that. Next slide, slide 28, please. This graphic at the bottom half of the slide shows a graphic from a European manual, and it's in meters. But it does a nice job of laying out where some of the materials will drop out when someone fires a shotgun shell. You have the empty cartridges immediately in front of the shooter. You have the trap system at a trap range throwing the clay target out. You have the plastic wads landing, say, about 30 meters in this case, out, perhaps less. You also have some of the fragments of the clay targets dropping, as well as some of the targets traveling even further if they were missed. And then the drop zone where the lead shot can end up, with the greatest shot concentrations being anywhere from 120 meters to 180 meters in this graphic. And we'll use some other graphics in a few moments to show you some other variations depending on what kind of ammunition is used. We also have, again, that's what the greatest concentration can be. There can be fine particulates and fragments of shot landing much closer in by the wads and the target fragments rather than out in the drop zone of where the lead shot is illustrated. Also, as that picture showed at the Olympics, and in this picture they showed a nice, neat little box to hold the shot shells. The picture above that is a range that shows that the various colors on the ground there, those are not wildflowers. Those are various colors of shot shells, blue, orange, whatever, that are just laying out on a range and not being picked up. Again, a lot of times the aesthetics of having material like that, it looks like it's unkept, it's a litter problem, and again, a lot of times members of the public will get turned off by seeing that type of thing. Next slide, slide 29, please. Sporting clays is becoming very popular. It's growing in popularity across the country, and what sporting clays is targets being thrown out from different locations and at different angles. So the shooter may be, for instance, in the bottom left-hand corner of this graphic, you see a target that's in close to the shooter, maybe bouncing along the ground in front of the shooter. And as they fire at it, the shot fall zone, a drop zone, could be in fairly close to the shooter, versus if you go up to more like the 12 o'clock position on this dramatic scale paper here, we have a couple of examples where the shot zone is way out there. It could be several hundred yards. And the problem with most of the sporting clays ranges is they do vary their arrangement over time. They could have vegetation damage develop from the shot and change the presentation of the target over time. So you end up with numerous shot fall zones in one specific area. And it, again, it can change, and it's important to keep track of where those shot fall zones could be. Next slide, slide 30, please. Here's a new way of arranging sporting clays in which you have a common shot fall zone. You rearrange it so that the stations are all shooting into a certain direction. Again, first factoring in safety concerns and making sure, as this one illustrates, that there's no overlap of any surface danger zones or hazards associated with the direction of fire. But again, it's a way to make the sporting clays range easier to do some collection of the ammunition in the future. Slide 31, please. On this range, it's a typical layout of a trap range. Trap range, the clay target is being thrown out away from the shooter in pretty much a uniform fashion. And the drop zone of an individual trap range is about 4 acres in size. And as you add on additional ranges, such as you see in the top half of the picture, you can add on about 1¾ acres per additional trap range. By again angling the direction of fire slightly differently, you can again reduce the footprint so that there's less of an area that has shot being distributed through it, and again possibly making it easier to recover some of the lead as time goes on. Next slide, slide 32, please. Skeet is, the third major sporting shotgun event that you see quite popular. The skeet ranges, depending upon the size shot, you could have typically 680 feet is the distance that you would see number 8 or number 9 shot travel out to. In this graphic, it assumes a maximum use of number 7.5 shot, so that the distance again would be similar to the maximum distance you'd see shot traveling out from the shooter's position as you would at a trap range. And because the fan is so wide, you have a theoretical drop zone from a single skeet field of 14 acres. Again, that's according to the National Shooting Sports Foundation, with additional 2 acres as you add additional skeet ranges. As you can see, there's 3 skeet ranges illustrated side by side here. Next slide, slide 33, please. Okay, in summary, you basically have range configuration is an important factor. You need to know where your projectiles are going in order to know where you need to assess its interaction with the environment. And it's seldom a straight road to figure out where things are going at a range. You know, one of the best things you can do, for instance, is go out on when the soil is very dry and just watch where the dust puffs come up as you see the bullets hit their initial target and then ricochet off in different directions. And you can see where you're likely to end up with projectiles building up over time. Similarly, I know that some folks go to military ranges to do assessments, and if they look at how their night operations are going and watching where the traces ricochet off to, it can really be illuminating, pun intended there, that you really see a great change in where you expect in the future you'd see projectiles ending up. Again, knowing the aerial extent of the range, it really factors into where you should be looking to see if there's environmental impacts. I think Bonnie will, in the later section, will be going over, again, some of the environmental impacts, and we'll focus on that a little bit more. Next slide, please. Slide 34. Okay, Mary?
Thanks, Mark. We do now have several minutes for questions and answers. Those of you on the phone lines will have a chance to ask your questions verbally. For those of you on simulcast, you can click on the question mark button and type in your question, and then you can submit that, and I will verbally ask your question, and you'll be able to hear their verbal response. So let's go ahead and start with a couple simulcast questions, and then we will come back to our phone lines. This first question is from Billy Umstead with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service out of Lakewood, Colorado. And he asks, what is the criteria for lead to be abandoned? How long must it be in the soil to be abandoned as long as the range is active?
This is Liz. Well, you can look to the EPA guidance document for some discussion of that, but the short answer is there is no precise period of time in which lead could be considered abandoned. EPA manual is based around the idea that lead will be recovered periodically. And for different volumes of lead being used at a range, they have a recommended period of recovery. So depending on how much lead is put down over time, they recommend recovery anywhere from every few years to, every 10 years, depending on how frequently the range is used. And they really do approach this that recovery is appropriate at most ranges. We, in the ITRC guidance, have also looked at other ways to manage lead and keep it stable that may be appropriate in some cases prior to recovery. But really, in order to, it's a very sort of loose line of when it's abandoned, but if you're being effective in preventing the impact from spreading and you're actively managing it, we take the position that the lead is not abandoned in that instance.
Here's a question from Ken Maas with the U.S. Forest Service out of Juneau, Alaska. And he says, is there nationwide NRA support for EMS at shooting ranges?
Liz, I'd be able to take that one.
Yeah. Okay.
From some of the interaction that I've had with NRA officials, I would say the answer is yes, that they being the NRA, has worked closely with National Shooting Sports Foundation and also SAMI, the Sporting Arms and Ammunition Manufacturers Institute. And while I can't point to any one document that they have put out themselves, I know that they have signed on to some statements of principles at the SHOT Show that involved a lot of mention of these kind of documents of environmental stewardship. Liz, did you want to add to that?
No, my answer was going to be yes, but I didn't know as much about the specifics as you do, Mark, so.
Okay, let's go ahead and move on to our phone line audience. If you have a question for the instructors, please state your name, where you're calling in from, and don't forget to take your phones off mute. If you use the *6 feature to mute your phone, you can unmute your phone by using *7.
Yeah, Mary, this is Greg Timoney in Jacksonville. I see us talking about lead. Is there any discussion or is there any documentation yet concerning combustion products on the brasses?
I can speak to that a little bit. This is Bonnie Packer. There have been some studies by the Army looking at emissions downrange from the projectiles entirely, and really there weren't any issues with the combustion products entirely from the different projectiles that the military uses.
Do any of the other instructors have information to add on that one?
No, I know that, for instance, at Mass Military Reservation, they've looked at some of the materials in front of the firing positions. But was your question more about the brass itself and the recycling of the materials and any concerns with contaminants on the brass?
Correct. Yeah, the residue that may be on the brass exposed to rain and what have you.
Well, I know one of the things that we encourage is the stewardship associated with maintaining what might otherwise be looked at as litter. That picture that I was using that showed all the shot shells on the ground, I could have easily gone to the other side of that same range where the rifle pistol range is, and there's literally thousands of brass cartridges all over the ground that haven't been picked up for an extended period of time, and it would make more sense to pick it up on a timely fashion and recycle it so you don't have a chance to have, you know, dozens and dozens of rain events rinsing the materials down into the soil. So the more you could have a stewardship plan that included the recovery and the recycling, more like the idealized pictures that were shown at the Olympics and at the other European diagram that showed the shot shells going into a bin, and that bin, for instance, be emptied at the end of the day. A lot of times the brass does have clearly a recycling value to it, and a lot of reloaders will use the shells, but the ones that are picked over and not used, they should be recovered and recycled.
Is there another question from the phone line audience?
Hello. Got a question. This is Dudley Patrick from Engineering Field Division in Charleston, South Carolina.
Yes, go ahead.
These models for the trap and skeet ranges, do they take into account the varying chokes that are available with shotguns, barrels? You have full chokes, improved chokes, modified chokes. You may have sawed-off shotgun barrels in law enforcement uses.
My understanding is, again, those came from both the Sporting Arms and Ammunition Manufacturers Institute and National Shooting Sports Foundation. I believe they're just generalized. I don't think they really changed. They would have different fans, for instance, for those specific changes in choke size. I think they're more of a round number, so to speak. And, again, depending on what's being used at an individual range, it sometimes might make a lot of sense to set up some kind of a, you know, literally containers that are put out in the range and see how far out some of the pellets end up. I've seen ranges where they've done tests in which they lay out plastic sheets on the ground and just see how far the projectiles are going at that specific location, given the altitude, giving some slope to the land. Again, those are just more or less round numbers.
Thank you.
Okay, we will go ahead and move on to some simulcast questions. This is from Heather Davies with the Department of Interior out of Washington, D.C. And she says, can you discuss the potential advantages and pitfalls of introducing green ammunition onto an active range that has not yet been reclaimed for lead?
I guess I'll take that one. well, the military is reevaluating the use of tungsten at the moment, and we've got an ongoing program to look at just that issue at three military installations, and we don't expect to have results from that analysis for at least another year. So I can't speak to the results except for the fact that there is the open issue. It's not clear how easy or how difficult it will be to manage the lead and the tungsten together.
Okay, here's a question, and it's referring specifically to slide number 16, and it's from Laura Ola with the Citizens for Safe Water around Badger, Merrimack, Wisconsin. And it says, on slide 16, the table of expected contaminants at ranges does not include explosives and deterrents such as dinitrotoluene. At the Massachusetts Military Reservation, for example, DNT was a significant contaminant of concern in the groundwater associated with the ranges there. As semi-volatiles are more mobile in the environment compared to metals, the potential risk to the groundwater and surface water may be underestimated if they are not based on metals. I think the DNTs and other explosives should receive as much attention as the metals in developing range management plans designed to minimize short-term and long-term environmental impacts. What are your opinions on this?
You want to take that one, Mark, or you want me to take that one?
Why don't you start, and then I'll finish.
All right. The military is embracing the notion of EMS, or environmental management planning, for all of its ranges. I think they're phasing it over several years, and so I guess I have to concur with the questioner in that both energetics as well as metals have to be considered when doing environmental management planning. So go ahead, Mark, finish up.
Yep. The other thing I was going to mention is a lot of times you have to watch out at some of the military ranges. It wasn't just, or in fact, it still isn't just small arms ammunition that's being used. A lot of times, for instance, you may have 40 millimeter grenades being used that are part of the weapon system attached to an M16. So you could have a range such as the one I illustrated with the soldiers lying down firing. That same range is also used for 40 millimeter grenades. And so you could have various other metals and other energetic compounds being out there mixed in, or and in some cases, clearly I would agree that they are most likely more mobile than some of the metals that you would have at the range. And you also have to look at how any UXO or other items could have been out on the range in the past before you start doing some range work. It's not unusual. I know at Mass Military Reservation, some of the work that was done in the past to remediate some of the berms or manage some of the berms, they found hand grenades and other items mixed in with the soils.
I think that the issue with a lot of military installations is that they have a lot of legacy issues because the ranges haven't always been laid out the way they are today. I think that's an important point.
See, here's a simulcast question, and Liz is kind of asking for clarification on something you referenced at the beginning, and from John Liptak with the New Hampshire Division of Environmental Services from Concord, New Hampshire, and it says, Liz stated at the beginning of her talk, she said something about the metallic form of lead is fairly inert. I would consider it still to be toxic to direct exposure or contact. I missed what she intended by her statement.
Well, I'll take that and expand upon it in my delivery in the next set of slides about just how reactive or how soluble it is. We'll expand upon that.
Okay. Let's go back to our phone lines one last time before we move to the second portion of our presentation. Any questions for the instructors?
Yes, this is Ed Brown from Air Force Center for Environmental Excellence in San Antonio, Texas. I have two questions. First question is the best practices for range management, is that based on a consensus or demonstrated practices?
I'm not sure I understand the difference between those two. Consensus that it is effective?
No, consensus that everyone agrees, yeah, that this is a good practice, or demonstrated that, yeah, it's been used and it is better over what has been done in the past.
I think it's both of those things. There's consensus building around the need to, where you have an active range, to be actively managing environmental conditions at the range and make that part of the maintenance of the range, make that a part of range operations. And in comparison to what's been done in the past, in many cases, there hasn't been any management of environmental issues at the range in the past. So people are catching up by first identifying whether past practices have led to the creation of environmental problems. So one of the first steps is determining whether there are any current issues, and then going forward, doing a better job of managing the lead and other materials to keep it in a form where it's stable and causing less impact than it would otherwise if you left it unmanaged.
I would just add that after Mike's presentation of the different technologies, probably a better time to talk about a lot of these techniques and how innovative and how new they are versus how tried and true they are. Maybe we should have a further discussion at that point.
That's a good suggestion.
One other note on the consensus. I don't know if the questioner was aware of the concurrence process that goes through. This goes beyond just the team and the people that participated here, but goes to the member states for review and concurrence as well. So it's not just the people involved in this call that put this together.
And it also went through a fairly extensive DOD review that Bonnie was involved with, and it went to quite high levels within the Pentagon.
Okay, we are going to have to wrap up this first question and answer period. I know there's some simulcast questions we haven't been able to get to and likely some phone line questions as well, but we'll do our best to get to those in the second question and answer period. So if everybody would now move on to slide number 35, I will turn it over to Bonnie Packer with the U.S. Army Environmental Center. Bonnie?
Hello, everyone. I'm going to pick up on slide 35 where Mark and Liz left off. And really what we're going to talk about in these next slides are how important it is to assess your range for the transport pathways and how they interact with the mass distribution that Mark talked about. So if you were to put together Liz's slide that talked about doing your baseline assessment and laying over a topo map or a aerial photograph and thinking about where the mass distribution of lead is that Mark talked about, and then overlay on top of that where your distribution pathways are for your surface water pathways and your wetlands and where the vegetation may or may not cover up the soil and prevent erosion. That's what really we're going to focus on here. And with that in mind, you should be able to do at least a preliminary mental assessment of whether or not you have particular environmental issues on your range. So with that, let's turn to slide 36 and talk about, in general, what the different fate and transport mechanisms are. Again, the most important thing, as Mark discussed at great length, is the math. How many years have you fired rounds? How many rounds per year do you think you've fired? This is one way for you to figure out what the total mass distribution is of lead. And even if it's an estimate, it's a very important estimate to make, because it's the first part of your assessment for your range. And then once you've got that picture, either on a topo map or on an aerial photograph, then think about the physical processes. The bullet fragmentation, if you look at that middle photograph there, you can see that there are rounds and there are stones there. The more the bullets are fragmented, the smaller the fragments are, the more potential there is for transport, whether it be by wind transport or water transport pathway. And in addition to them, the bullets impacting the hard objects in the soil like rocks, there's also repeated impacts from subsequent bullets. So again, the breakup, the amount of bullet fragmentation is very important there for the physical process of then taking that mass and moving it via wind or water transport processes. And a third process we're going to talk about in more detail in a few slides are the chemical processes that may act on the lead. And that is, although lead is very sparingly soluble, it does have a defined solubility. And that solubility is at a minimum at a neutral pH. So if you can keep the pH of your soils and your lead in their soils at near neutral, say between 6 and 9, this prevents the dissolution of the lead into either surface water or groundwater. So when we talk about the dissolution, what we really mean is that the metallic lead becomes oxidized and molecules of the lead actually mix in with the water. And although we said it's sparingly soluble, it does happen, and there are situations where you've got a naturally low pH soil. Let's say you've got, you know, a pine forest or whatever, and you've got a below 5 pH. There you've got to worry about the dissolution of the lead from its metallic form and coming into the pore water or into the surface water. Even though it may dissolve at a fairly higher rate, there are other processes that can prevent the movement of the lead vertically. It can adsorb to clays or organic matter. After it goes into solution, it can recrystallize out. If there is a limestone-based soil, it can form a lead carbonate and reprecipitate out. If it's a phosphate-based soil, it could form a lead phosphate and reprecipitate out. So these are some of the chemical processes that are important with regard to lead. With that, let's move to the next slide, slide 37, and focus a little bit more detail in the surface water particulate transport. Both, as Liz mentioned earlier, both the soil and lead are subject to erosion and surface water transport. And what we want to look at is how much of the incoming rainwater is going to soak into the soil versus run off and carry both soil particulate and lead with it. And really, the way to do that, once again, is with a surface topo map to look at what the angles are and how big your basin is, how much water actually is moving over where your high mass of lead is. If you know what your shotfall distribution is or your lead distribution is, and you know you've got most of the water running over that particular area of your range, then you can suspect that there's potentially a surface water transport issue. Some of the resources impacted are the surface water quality, fish and wildlife habitat, and wetlands. And the factors to consider with regard to surface water particulate transport are again, as we said earlier, the sizes and the masses of the particles. The smaller the particle sizes, the more they're going to stay suspended in surface water. So if you've got your streams very close by to your range, and you've got high-intensity rainfall there, you have a potential for a horizontal or a surface water transport issue. The rainfall intensity in your area is very important. Do you have just light rainfall, or are you in an arid environment? Or do you have frequent intense rainfalls? And those frequent intense rainfalls you can see in the lower figure there cause significant surface water transport. You can see this very sandy environment moving both the particles of soil as well as the lead from the berm on the left there off into a local stream for that particular range. Whereas the upper photograph is from a range where there isn't a lot of surface water transport. The soils are very permeable there, and there's just a very localized erosion, you know, a meter or two. And then because the water soaks in, there isn't any horizontal transport. And lastly, how available are those particles to any surface water? If you're guiding your water away, as you'll see, let's move to slide 38. There we talk about some options to manage the surface water particulate transport. And if you look at the figure below, even let's say if you had your range situated in an area where a lot of the surface water moves past your range, one could build, say, side berms to divert the flow of water so that the bulk of the clean storm water flow does not impact where you expect your lead to be. So your options to manage your lead are very much associated with the different ways that the particles move. The particle availability, if you have a heavily vegetated area, you could use soil amendments. You could control water velocity by changing the slope of your berm. We found in the military that a slope of 2-to-1 or less is effective. Just like the Department of Transportation uses riprap beside the highways, you could use that as a way of slowing down the water and lowering its potential to move both sediment and lead. And Mike's going to talk a little bit more about those different mechanisms. You can manage it by periodic removal, and Mike's going to tell us a lot more about containment structures like bullet traps. But just before we go here, in terms of making an assessment, again, of whether you may or may not have a surface water particulate transport issue, the use of a topo map, the distance between your range and the surface water is important. And also, I mean, unless it's obviously lightning and thundering out, you can actually just stand outside in a light rain and watch to see how much transport there is sometimes. And in assessing your soil type, too, you can make a fairly clear assessment about how transportable the material is. Silt is apparently the most transportable. Let's move to slide 40 and talk a little bit about air particulate transport. Actually, I think I went too far. Nope. 39. Air particulate transport. Again, the soil and lead is transported via air. And as you can see in the photograph there, you can see the soldiers are firing. You can see little puffs of soil as the impact of the round. And there is no vegetative cover on that range. And so if there were strong winds there as they were firing, there would be the potential for air transport. Some resources that are impacted, if there's nearby surface water, there's the potential for surface water quality to be impacted. There's a potential if there are nearby receptors like grazing wildlife or grazing animals. And of course, if you've got a big dust issue, it can affect the aesthetics and can affect the folks that are firing on the range workers themselves. The different factors that influence the erosion of soil and lead via wind are the air velocities. You can oftentimes you can get these wind velocities easily available. Lots of at least military installations have the wind socks. They monitor this very carefully. And I believe it's also available online. I've gotten it before online. The particular types of soils that are most susceptible, particle size is very important. Silt is very transportable by air, and the way the particles move is by basically jumping. They move by impacting each other. One moves, and then it hits the next, and then if you've ever been in a windstorm, you know it can really sting. So, and once again, how available are those particles to the wind? How much vegetative cover you have is very important to both air erosion as well as water erosion. Now let's move to slide 40. Options to manage. We can affect the particle availability by affecting how much vegetative cover and amending your soil and adding vegetative cover. How much in terms of windbreaks you have, the photograph at the bottom of the slide shows that this is a very well-vegetated range in terms of how much grass there is, but also there are effective windbreaks there. So this can be very important. And again, a periodic lead mass removal is important, and there's also the potential for lead containment structures to prevent air particulate transport. So what are the ways you could assess your range? Again, using the use of aerial photographs, topographic maps, assessing wind speeds, how much vegetation you have, what types of vegetation, what types of soils you have. Watching your range on a windy day is also an effective mechanism. So let's move to slide 41 and talk a little bit about vertical transport and lead dissolution. Although lead dissolution is not frequently an issue, it is occasionally an issue. And there, again, although lead has a very low solubility at neutral pH, it can dissolve if the pH is too low. And some of the factors to take into account are, what is the depth of your water table? If you have a very shallow water table and you have a low or a high pH, this is a potential for lead to move vertically and to become a water issue. The resources impacted could be both groundwater and surface water in wetlands, as well as fish and wildlife. And you see in the figure there that there's a situation here where the lead shot drop zone is in an area where the water table is both shallow, and then once it gets the lead is moving into the groundwater, it moves to the right there into a surface water body. So you have both a groundwater issue in this case as well as a surface water issue. The factors, again, that influence the solubility of lead are the pH, which is a good thing because this is a fairly easy thing, as Michael discussed, to control what the redox potential is. Most soils are oxygenated, although not all. And how much clay you have and the organic matter you have in your soil is very important because lead is very easily adsorbed onto clay. And again, as I said before, the distance to groundwater is a very important factor. Let's move to slide 42, different options to manage. I'm going to go breeze through these pretty quick because Mike's going to go over them in more detail. pH amendments, both carbonate and phosphate, these are mechanisms to control lead dissolution. There are stabilization techniques. There's addition of clay material to adsorb and retard the vertical movement. There's the use of alternative ammunition. There are several different types. I've heard copper, I've heard steel, I've heard tungsten. There's all different kinds of alternative ammunition. There's periodic removal. And again, there are containment structures. So in addition to those basic surface water, groundwater, air issues, there are some additional issues that we'll see on slide 43. Exposure is very important. Potential exposure if you go back to those topo and aerial photographs to imagine looking how close your source area is, your mass is, to local grazing animals or any other potential receptors is very important. In addition to that, range workers and making sure that they use standard practices like not eating on the range and cleaning their hands and so forth. And as I said, off-range plants, foraging animals, and grazing livestock, and making those considerations. Slide 44. Some additional issues. Shooting sound, as Liz mentioned, although not entirely an environmental issue, is an important one for ranges to be good stewards and good neighbors. Oftentimes this can increase the scrutiny on the range where there might not have been an environmental issue, there might be one. Some management techniques for sound and being good neighbors, the range orientation, if it's possible to change that, sometimes it can improve the sound. The hours of operations, there are potential berms that one can build to absorb sound and sound barriers. The military and law enforcement have the ability to use sound suppressors on their rifles and so forth. Another issue is trash litter and debris. This is important to, again, be a good steward and a good neighbor, and it can decrease the amount of scrutiny on the range. If you manage both the litter and trash on your range, it's more likely that you'll be a good environmental steward as well. So it influences public perception. As we heard from Mark, it's important to manage the WADs as well and the target waste. And in terms of trash, litter, and debris, management techniques are fairly straightforward. Routine collection and disposal of the trash, having trash receptacles on your range, and the use, if you have problems with wind, of netting to capture windblown litter. And as we mentioned in one of the question and answer, another issue, especially on military ranges, is the presence of unexploded ordnance, and there we let the explosive ordnance disposal folks deal with any ordnance that may be found on the range. In summary, on slide 45, the issues that we covered were knowing your mass and where it is, knowing how close and how much surface water you have on your range, knowing how your groundwater may or may not be affected by the environmental conditions of your soil, your pH, and the distances to groundwater. Air, we covered the air potential for air transport. And lastly, the most important thing to leave you with is that with regard to fate and transport, the most important thing is to control the lead and keep it on the ranges. With that, I'll hand it over.
Okay. Am I coming through here, Mary?
Yes, you sound fine.
Okay, great. Moving on to slide 46, what we're doing is trying to identify best management practices to deal with all the issues that have been discussed to date. Moving on to slide 47 is another decision tree to follow through, looking at the different alternatives and the effects on mitigating impacts of surface water and groundwater. They're listed there. There's no need to read those. We'll go through those in a bit more detail in subsequent slides. But summarizing quickly what Mark, Liz, and Bonnie had discussed, big issues are keeping the lead on the range and also preventing erosion. Probably the single biggest potential exposure on a range is erosion, mainly by water runoff, but potentially also by air. Moving on to slide 48, what we need to identify and manage are environmental goals for each range. The first of which would be to manage potential impacts which the range will pose to minimize impacts to the environment, public health, and or public welfare. Again, summarizing what had been said before, the biggest issue in the environmental management is to keep the lead on site. We jokingly talk about two ways the lead leaves the site. One is the high-speed lead migration, which is a ricochet or a direct round leaving the site, and the low-speed migration, which is associated with erosion or dissolution. Also important notes here are to keep or prevent the projectiles from impacting wetlands or surface waters, and also to reduce the noise, as Bonnie mentioned, the surrounding properties. Moving on to slide 49, with regard to the range of environmental management, very important note here that all of the options are range specific, what works at a site in the eastern U.S. may or may not have direct applicability to the western U.S. What you need to do is you need to have a thorough understanding of the environmental issues at each site, as well as the consequences of not managing it, and realize that there's certain costs for each of the different approaches, and you have to evaluate everything from a cost-effectiveness and schedule impact standpoint. Moving on to slide 50, probably the most important piece of the best management practices is proactive lead management. This does involve some periodic lead removal and recycling. The superficial buildup is a function of the ultimate use, how many shooters are there, how many rounds they shoot per trip, and that will dictate what the potential maintenance period may be. For very lightly used ranges, it could be years. For very heavily used military installations, it could be a year or less. The actual removal can involve mechanized or hand sifting, again, based on the size and the scope. There are also vacuum systems for skeet and trap ranges. There's a reference there to the Smart One ITRC document. In there is a very detailed evaluation of all of the removal technologies, which can be referenced. Also important, I had mentioned the erosion, is the fact that grading and slope maintenance is critical. What you do need to do is prevent the erosion and the washout. You see in the picture there, the top photo, severely eroded berm. This channels contaminants in the way of fine lead off-site. One of the benefits of properly maintaining the berm face is that you do improve bullet capture. There's less sharp edges to cause a potential ricochet. Moving on to slide 51, some additional proactive lead management methods. You have soil pH adjustment. In areas where there's very acid soils, you can slow or prevent lead dissolution by maintaining the soil in the ideal pH range. And again, this is adjustable through commercially available amendment addition. One thing to note, not all soils are low pH or acidic. There's many areas in the United States which have very alkaline soils or very high pH. So soil pH adjustment there may need to be adjusted downward, and automatically applying lime or other alkaline materials may not always solve the problem. There's also chemical stabilization methods. An alternate to simply adjusting the soil pH is to chemically bind any potentially dissolved lead. Again, these are commercially available products, predominantly phosphate or sulfate based. And as with the removal technologies, there is a collection of these in the Smart One document. Moving on to slide 52, another proactive lead management activity would be to use non-lead ammunition. By having non-lead ammunition, lead management becomes a non-issue. There are non-lead bullets available, frangible copper, I should say, and tungsten. As Bonnie had mentioned earlier, the tungsten is currently being reappraised. There are non-lead shot for sporting shotgun shooters. This could be steel or others, bismuth, tin, etc. While they do have advantages that you're reducing the potential exposure to lead, there could be a higher cost, and there could be ancillary additional cost involved with this through more stringent oversight and compliance. One note here, since most of the non-lead shots are harder, there are some safety concerns, and that this shot will bounce if it hits something hard like the clay targets on occasion or the ground, and it could cause some safety concerns that wouldn't normally be evident with lead shot. Moving on to slide 53, stormwater management and erosion control, as I mentioned previously, is paramount to good range management practices. This is the most significant potential migration pathway. It's definitely the slow speed pathway. Some methods to deal with this involve terracing and altering the topography, basically sound civil engineering drainage practices. You could do this with retention ponds and berms, as noted in the little graphic in the slide. If you divert the water away from the lead that's laying or captured in the berm, you're minimizing potential exposures. You can also vegetate the berms to aid in erosion control, as Bonnie had mentioned, either using riprap and hay bales, and periodic removal of lead from the highest concentration area will also help mitigate off-site erosion. Moving on to slide 54. Part of best management practices equates to common sense application, and this is one of those here. Any range that's in existence would want to be aligned to avoid shooting into or over water bodies or wetlands. There's ways to deal with this. Liz had mentioned the shot curtains. There was an email today that there's some new fabrics out which are performing very well. And there's the demonstrations soon to take place with the new fabric for the shot curtain. This is basically the same as a shower curtain that hangs at the far end of a trap and skeet range to knock the shot down and minimize the footprint. In Europe, they also use berms for this, for shotgun ranges. Berms are common for small arms, rifle, and handgun. They've also been used for shotguns as well to minimize the footprint, and of course the non-lead ammunition. What needs to be also considered here is the fact that the shot fall zone, in addition to not extending into a waterway, needs to be maintained on the facility property and not impinge on neighboring properties. Moving on to slide 55, other considerations for range management include minimization of wildlife exposure to the potential lead. Shooting into the water is a good way to start this, and that's addressed through operational planning. Also incorporating vegetation that does not attract wildlife on the range itself, such as fescue grasses. Creating management plots away from the range to intentionally attract wildlife works hand in hand with the fescue grasses on the range itself. And again, proactive lead management. If the lead is not accumulating and laying on the ground, the wildlife will not be exposed to it or as likely to be exposed to it. Moving on to slide 56. The previous methods were pretty much dealing with earth berms, which by far are the most popular and least expensive containment methods at firing ranges. However, for law enforcement and certain military situations where there's very heavily used ranges with a very small footprint or encroachment such that the surface danger zone requirements dictate more stringent containment, there are some engineered technologies which I'll go through here. The first of which is an engineered berm. This can be either a ballistic sand or granular rubber, and also bullet traps. There's two basic types. There's a steel trap or block traps, which are bullet-absorbing media. Both of these need to be managed for safety concerns as well as environmental stewardship. And as with the earth berms, they also do require regular maintenance to maintain their effectiveness. What you see there in those photos, the top photo would be an engineered sand berm. What you have to the right, lower right, would be a ballistic block, rubber block berm. And what you have on the lower left would be a steel bullet trap. Moving on to slide 57. For the engineered berms, like I mentioned, you can't have either ballistic sand or granular rubber. Basically, you have native soil underlaying the berm, and then as you see in that photo there, a catchment filled with a ballistic material. The big difference between the rubber and the sand, number one, is cost. The rubber is more expensive, but number two, the rubber does have limitations in that tracers or full automatic fire are not allowed to be used. Not generally a concern for sportsman ranges, but could be a concern for law enforcement or military use. Again, both of these require maintenance, and the maintenance for these is consistent with the lead berm, which includes periodic grading, proactive lead management and removal, and also the stormwater considerations. Moving on to slide 58, bullet traps are also an engineered system, a step up in cost, and also correlates to slightly less maintenance than the engineered berms. There are, as noted earlier, several different types. The steel bullet traps, which is basically top and bottom rants, funneling the rounds into a D-cell chamber where they're slowed eventually and collected in an auger system. Or the media block, which can be rubber or shock-absorbing concrete, stacked to serve as a ballistic wall. Again, both of these also need to be managed for safety issues and environmental stewardship. The big issue here is periodic inspection, especially on the rubber block wall, because what you're doing there is accumulating the rounds in the face of the wall, and once they're saturated, the saturated blocks need to be removed and replaced, and this would apply for both the rubber block as well as the shock-absorbing concrete. Some of the benefits of these on the environmental stewardship side is they do contain and reduce potential exposure to water. However, any contact water touching the range still does need to be managed, as noted in the previous slides. Moving on to slide 59, the maintenance issues here for the steel bullet trap, visual inspection, as well as periodic maintenance of conveyance systems. These are relatively low maintenance. However, when maintenance is required, it does require the range to be shut down, which is typical of any. And based on what lead collection systems are used, can be as simple as emptying a bucket, or for an automated auger systems, the lead is consolidated into a single drum, speeding up the actual change out and collection of the lead. When designing a range or considering engineered solutions, considerations for maintenance include, from a direct cost standpoint, the frequency and duration of the downtime. Other considerations, again, engineering in bolt-in parts for simplified replacement, and the life cycle cost associated with the equipment. Generally, for the steel bullet traps, a 10-year life cycle is not uncommon. Moving on to slide 60, on the media or the block traps, again, visual inspection. Vendors typically suggest rotating the blocks, or rotating the target positions, I should say, to extend the trap life. By moving the targets side to side in the lane for different training days, you're impacting the blocks at a different point, so you're not saturating the same point. You're spreading the lead impacts out over, which will move out and extend the maintenance period. When the blocks are saturated, they will have to be replaced. The actual lead removal and recycling for the block traps involves recycling the entire block. For the shock-absorbing concrete, traditionally this is recycled as a non-hazardous waste. For the rubber blocks, it's recycled at a smelter, with the rubber being consumed as part of the fuel for the smelter itself. Again, as with the steel trap, we have maintenance considerations. You do have the frequency and duration of the downtime. Different consideration here is the actual weight of the blocks. The rubber may be able to be moved by hand when it's new, but when it's saturated with lead, it might require heavy equipment to remove it. One other consideration in using the block wall is the fact that the blocks that get saturated are normally in the bottom third of the wall. All the blocks above them have to be removed to be able to access the block you're getting at. So there is a little more labor-intensive work involved here, which translates into more downtime from the training schedule. Moving on to slide 61, summarizing the technology considerations. First and foremost, each range is unique and needs to be evaluated based on site-specific requirements. When you're looking at containment and best management practices. The size and location of the range are critical, both to avoid shooting into water as well as making sure all of the rounds that do fall on your property. Other considerations, the type of firearm and what training scenarios are going to be used, number of rounds to be fired per lane, and any potential targetry system requirements will all play into the total range cost and life cycle management cost. On the site-specific side, static temperatures during operations may not seem like a critical consideration, but if you're shooting into an earth berm in a northern environment in the middle of winter when it's frozen, likely the earth berm is not going to be trapping any rounds. For the engineered systems, where you do have some structural components, you will have to take into account the statutory snow and wind loads, as well as the anticipated rainfall, which would fall to any of the considerations to incorporate in the site draining plan. One of the suggestions, strong suggestions actually, if you're considering any engineered equipment options, is to go see one in operation that you're thinking of buying. Interview the end users, get the real life cycle costs. Don't listen to the vendors when they tell you what it's going to cost to operate. Go talk to somebody who's actually got one in service and get the real cost. And it's not just the capital cost. The last bullet there, I think, says it all, is your range downtime has a life cycle cost associated with it, so you need to factor in the actual range downtime when you're doing your life cycle cost analysis. With that, I'll turn it back over to Liz to expand on the environmental management planning and operations and engineering.
Thanks, Mike. I'm going to finish up now by moving from all the information that's been presented so far and talk about how you take that and use it and incorporate it into putting together an environmental management plan and putting that plan into writing, which is something we stress the importance of getting this all down on paper. And slide 62, you see that flow chart again. We've talked about environmental stewardship principles, doing baseline range assessment, identifying environmental issues particular to your ranges. And Mike has just gone through the available best management practices that you could apply to those conditions. Now we're going to talk about the process of selecting among those different alternatives and preparing an environmental plan and moving on from there to implementing and monitoring that plan. Slide 63, please. This slide really summarizes the best management alternatives in and organizes it in terms of first the range type, whether you're talking about shotgun ranges or rifle pistol ranges, and also whether it's a change in how you're operating the range, change in practice, or a change that involves implementing some engineered approach. This is just a good reference in terms of when you get down to the job of actually selecting which alternatives to apply at your range, referring back to this summary and which would be useful for the problems that you've identified. And I also want to stress that you're not necessarily picking one alternative or one practice, but it could be a combination of these things, and you may also be looking both what can be done in the short term to address the most critical problems and what other things could be phased in over the long term. You may need to raise some funds to implement some changes, and they may be more long-term changes. So this is all goes into selecting what approaches will be useful at your range. Slide 64, please. This slide presents a table that's in the guidance document, and it's really just a tool for organizing information about various alternatives and comparing them side by side. In terms of actually documenting your decision-making process, a table of this sort would be useful in terms of presenting how you evaluated various alternatives, one against the other, or combinations of alternatives, and how you weighed them in terms of the benefits they provide, and also the costs in terms of actual monetary costs or downtime or maintenance and people you would need to implement them, that sort of thing, to weigh those, weigh all of those factors and help to come to a rational choice about which alternatives are going to work best at your range. Slide 65, please. We like to stress that even if the issues at your range are fairly straightforward, in every case, it really makes sense to document the conditions at your range, your baseline evaluation, your selection of alternatives, and your management alternatives that you're going to put in place to put those things into writing. One of the things we've talked about is it's not only useful for your purposes, but it also is evidence that you are out there actively managing the lead and other materials at the range. So this documentation could be useful in terms of providing that demonstration that as the range manager, you are actively dealing with these concerns. Slide 66, please. The guidance document, table 4.3 in the guidance document, provides a checklist for the elements that go into a written environmental management plan. And there's an appendix in the document as well that provides an outline for a plan. So as a range manager, you could use that outline and as the starting point for filling in the different parts of an environmental management plan that's specific to your range. And the first part of that plan will include the information that you gathered as part of that baseline assessment. And that's going to be the point that you look back to in order to judge how effective your best management practices are as you go forward and implement them. And we like to stress that that part of the report should be very heavy on materials such as photographs and maps and actual descriptions of range conditions so that you can have some qualitative and quantitative measures to start from when you look back to see what kind of effect you're having when you're implementing the BMPs at the range. Then other materials would include the basis for selecting the best management alternatives that I talked about, justification for what was selected, and planning in terms of how it will be implemented and the schedule and how you will go back and monitor those activities and make modifications to the plan as needed. Slide 67. This slide shows what documentation might look like in terms of actual implementation once you've selected different best management practices and broken it down into various tasks that need to be done in order to get the work done. You list those tasks and a schedule for starting and completing it, what you'll be spending on it. And I like to emphasize, I think one of the most important pieces in the implementation of the plan is to clearly identify who will be responsible for getting the task done. I think this is a place where plans can often fall down in that there's some general agreement on what should be done, but there's less clarity as to who's going to do it and ensure that the project stays on schedule and actually happens. Slide 68, please. On to the final steps of actually implementing the plan. And one of the critical elements is that once the plan is implemented, that it be monitored on an ongoing basis to determine whether it's being implemented effectively and whether any adjustments need to be made in order to achieve whatever the goal of the best management practice was. And this monitoring would be looking and evaluating the best management practice in terms of its effectiveness relative to the conditions that you started with that you were trying to improve. And it can be both quantitative and qualitative in terms of the measurements that you're using. You'll want to identify how are we going to measure how effective this is. If, for example, we're talking about vegetation and we started with an area that we have a photograph that looked like this, you want to document improvements using photographs or talking about percentage of coverage, some sort of measures that will really help you get a handle on whether or not the plan is having its desired effect. Slide 69, please. So in summary, I'd like to emphasize the importance of once you have all these pieces in place and you have an understanding of what you're trying to accomplish and you've selected best management practices, all of those steps along the way should be clearly documented in writing. And the documentation is useful not only for the range manager in terms of providing a blueprint for the work that needs to be done and has been done. It's also very useful if you have new people involved in the management of the range. It serves as a record of the decision-making process and why things are being done the way they're being done and the monitoring you've done along the way to make modifications to plans if needed. And it also, importantly, shows the efforts the range is making in terms of managing lead and other materials at the range. So I finally would like to stress the importance of documenting all the work that's being done and the planning process in this document and have this document be a living sort of plan for the range that is updated as you go along and as necessary. And with that, I'll turn things back to Mary for a final question and answer period.
Thanks, Elizabeth. We do again have several minutes for questions and answers, but before we get to those questions, I'd like everybody to move on to slide 70 and then on over to slide 71, and I want to take you to the links to additional resources. So if you click on the text that says links to additional resources, that will allow you to get to our links page where you can download a copy of today's presentation, which does include some additional speaker's notes. You can also download the guidance document that served as the basis for this training course, as well as the document that was focused on characterization and remediation at soils that closed small arms firing ranges that was referenced also in today's training. If you scroll on down below the ITRC specific links into other links, you'll see there's a variety of links from different organizations and agencies. This page will remain active if you'd like to come back to it at a later date and use it as a resource. You're certainly welcome to do that. Scrolling on down further, there's a direct link to the ITRC website, so if you'd like to find out more information of what our technical teams are doing and also access a variety of other guidance documents ITRC teams have worked on, or to find out who your state point of contact is, that information is available on the ITRC website. You can also link to additional internet-based trainings as listed in Section 4. If you scroll on up to the top, under the CLUE and SUD, the third bar down says feedback. If you'd please click on that feedback button and give us some feedback on how the training went for you today. We would very much appreciate it. Now, we do have several questions to get to, so I'm going to ask our instructors to be as concise as possible in their answers, and also those of you asking questions on phone lines to be as concise as possible in your questions. So let's first start with the phone lines this time. If you have a question for the instructors, please state your name and where you're calling in from.
Hi. This is Marcia Rose Ritchie. I'm in Douglas, Wyoming. And we have a couple of questions, actually. First being, what are your recommendations for dealing with user-created, rather broad-scale shooting areas, not designated shooting ranges, but areas that we've discovered that people have adopted as a de facto shooting range area on public land? How do you recommend that we deal with those?
Which instructor wants to jump in on that one?
I'll take a shot, Mary. It's Mark. Obviously, if you have, not an organized shooting area, you have various targets being moved, as I was mentioning in my presentation, over time. You just have a situation where it's ultimately very, very difficult to manage any environmental impacts within that fairly broad, diffuse area. If there's a way to try and organize some of those areas into having a defined shooting range, I think it would be better for the environment at least, and probably from
a safety point of view, it may also be better for everyone involved. You don't want to have two separate groups of shooters organizing to start shooting ultimately in the same direction as each other. And if you don't have defined safety areas and directions of fire, you're just asking for an accident because, as you know, in some cases it can be miles that the bullet will travel.
Yes, we are. And that kind of leads to my second question. Thank you for that answer. What is our obligation then for cleaning up one of these areas that we've discovered is being used in this fashion?
It really, it depends on, you know, the state laws involved. You could argue that if you're just changing something from an unorganized range into a more organized range, it might not necessarily trigger any cleanup or closure requirements. You may ultimately find you're going to use the same area that's been used the most in the past and just now make it defined that that is the only area that you're using. So it again, as most of the presenters said today, it ultimately gets to a site-specific case-by-case decision.
To add to what Mark had mentioned there, if your climate's relatively dry, you might not have as much of an issue with the lead on the ground as you might think from an impact to groundwater or a possible erosion problem as well. So one of the things you might want to look at is maybe a little precursory study of what the actual soil conditions are at the site and what impacts the lead has had to date.
Okay, we're going to go ahead and move on to a simulcast question. We'll come back to the phone lines a little bit later. This next question is from Belinda Walker with the USDA Forest Service out of San Bernardino, California. And she says, the question concerns the use of vegetative cover as a best management practice. Is there data available, or do you know the minimum amount of vegetative cover needed before you begin to see results?
I don't know if there's ever been a study that looked at percent cover for how effective it is at being a filter strip, but I know that the Army's done some studies where they've not had a filter strip and then added a filter strip and seen how effective it is. Certainly, having some is better than none. I don't think there's a percent cover that's been known to be more effective than another.
So here's a question from Wilbur Martinez with the U.S. Forest Service out of Washington, D.C., and he asks, has any state pursued a shooting range for a RCRA violation and issued fines and or penalties that you are aware of?
That sounds like one for Rick Patterson, probably more than any. What wasn't the one in Connecticut and the one in New York, Mark Begley, weren't they chased for RCRA violations?
A lot of times in the past, most of the case studies that I've seen, both in the National Shooting Sports Foundation document as well as some others, I believe the EPA manual also has examples of case studies that are out there showing some of the both legislative history as well as case law that developed. A lot of times you had citizen action lawsuits triggering actions, and it really oftentimes wasn't a regulatory agency starting an enforcement action. I know EPA Region 2 has recently worked with a number of county organizations within their region to look at signing agreements to change practices at some of their ranges. But I don't think there's been a lot of enforcement actions. I know, Mike, the reason you were mentioning Rick Patterson, National Shooting Sports Foundation tries to keep track of all of those enforcement actions across the country. But I don't think there has been a lot of them. Again, a lot of times it's more of a citizen lawsuit driver than it is a regulatory driver.
And, Mary, maybe a good follow-up was to have the person who asked the question drop an email, and we can get that to Rick.
Okay, will do. Here's a question from Josh Brody with the Marine Corps out of Camp Pendleton, California. He wants to know if there's any sample scopes of work for range assessments that would be accessible to him.
You can have him direct that question to me, and I can
get it staffed and sent back to him.
Okay, will do. Here's a question from Terry Smith with ELM Incorporated out of Princeton, New Jersey. And she says, many of these ranges have been operating for a long time and have accumulated a lot of spent shot. How do you implement best management practices on an operating range that includes stabilizing soils and providing soil to enhance or restart distressed vegetation when many state land use laws prohibit the use of adding soil to the site on top of existing contaminated soil?
I think what you have to look at there is a definition of the soil and the active range classification, that it's not a waste as long as the range is active. And the soil that you're adding is a construction material to maintain the operational ability of the range itself.
Okay, and she goes on with an additional question that says, does a shooting range need to implement a full-blown remedial plan to clean up the site before implementing best management practices?
No.
What do you suggest? Okay, there was a strong no from the group.
That was a strong no. In fact, the two are mutually exclusive. If it's an active range, there's no remedial investigation. You're actively managing the lead in the range, and so you don't need a remedial investigation.
And if I could, Mary, just add to Mike's answer that in some cases it may be prudent to excavate some of the soil, for instance, take up just the top, you know, several inches of soil, move it aside, then bring in some clean fill to, say, change in elevation, build a berm, and then use that soil that has the lead in it as the new face of a berm. So, again, you're not burying over the old soil that has the high lead levels in it. You're using it in an area where you're most likely to have future lead be deposited. So again, you're not, if at some point in the future you do end up closing a range, you haven't complicated the cleanup. You actually may have made it easier if you think through where you would bring in the fill and how to manage the existing soil.
Okay, let's go back to our phone line audience. If you have a question for the instructors, please state your name and where you're calling in from.
This is Larry Donovan from the Forest Service out in the Seattle, Washington area, and I was wondering if you could give some more information on curtains as far as cost, limitations for height, and any materials they're made out of.
I might be able to give information based on the few curtains that I know of in Massachusetts. There's some shooting sports clubs in Massachusetts. I think at this point, four or five have installed curtains. And they developed these curtains pretty much from scratch themselves to start, and they would use telephone poles to hang the curtains and green nylon material as the curtain fabric. And I know the one club that gave us their costs, Mark, correct me if I'm recalling this wrong, but I think the total cost was $15,000 to install the curtain, and most of those costs had to do with the curtain fabric material. Also, there are new curtain fabrics under development. The problem with the existing curtains is that we don't know how long they will last in the environment once they're up there. So there is research being done. As Mike mentioned, the University of Massachusetts has developed a fabric which they think that will stay up in the environment and withstand photo degradation over time. So if anyone's interested in that, I have more information on that curtain material under development, and that you can email me and I'll send you that information.
Yeah, and I just want to confirm that is the number I recall too, and that was for a trap range as opposed to a skeet range, so it was a narrower, shorter curtain than would have been necessary.
And it was a single field as well.
Correct.
Is there another question from the phone lines?
Yeah, this is Greg Timmy down in Jacksonville again. I'm curious if anyone knows if DOD is actually investigating lead-free primers. We've got some indoor ranges where that's an issue. And is there a NALC already for lead-free ammunition in DOD?
As far as I know, there is not an initiative to look at the primers at the moment. There is a total revamping of the 5.56 round, and they are moving from what was a tungsten nylon round and still considering tungsten and considering a lead-free round, although they haven't ruled that out. So there's a whole redesign in process for the 5.56 round. Does that answer your question?
Yes, ma'am.
Actually, they had done, the Picatinny guys, I believe, had done some research on the non-lead primers, and what they found is they didn't perform as well as the traditional primers at the extreme temperatures, especially the cold end. So that's one of the reasons that they didn't formally look forward or move forward with that, is they couldn't get reliable performance to meet mil-spec.
Since tungsten was just mentioned, I'll read a couple questions here asked by two different people. One, Mike Carras from TCOM Ranges with U.S. Marine Corps out of Quantico, Virginia, and the other from Billy Umstead with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service out of Lakewood, Colorado. And they're both related to the same topic here. It says, why is tungsten being reappraised? Are these the green ammunitions, or excuse me, the green munitions everyone talks about? And then I'll go ahead and read the next question. It says, if tungsten is being reappraised, has the military or other private ranges stopped using it? Please explain what you know about tungsten. What green ammunition do you recommend for small ranges?
Well, the primary reason that they're reevaluating the tungsten ammunition has to do with the fact that it wasn't performing properly. It was tumbling and didn't perform in the barrel or even out of the barrel the way that the original 5.56 round did. Then there are also some environmental considerations, and the Army's now investigating. There was a preliminary laboratory study that looked at the solubility of the round and in the environment, and it caused us to think about reassessing the round environmentally. And now we're going to do a field scale investigation at three installations. One installation has been chosen, and that field work is set to start next month up at Cape Cod, but MMR. And the other two installations have not been chosen yet, so we're still looking for places to go and do that field work.
Are there other green ammunitions that are being used?
I believe there are some plastic rounds that are being used, even up at Cape Cod. Maybe Mark can speak to that.
Yeah, they're not currently being used. In the past, there were some kind of rubber bullet used with the M16, but they did not perform very well. The soldiers did not like training with them. There's also a number of other ammunitions that are used for waterfowl hunting, because we've been mainly talking about the military use of the green ammo, but one of the questions is from Fish and Wildlife that, as you know, there's a prohibition on use of lead ammunition in waterfowl hunting, and I believe some number like 8 of the last 10 ammunitions that have been approved for waterfowl hunting have involved tungsten. There's also bismuth and steel and other materials out there. But again, some of the mobility data on tungsten are not looking good. And some studies that have been done recently also are looking at the potential for the tungsten as it oxidizes to change the pH of the soil and the berm. And so there's questions about what may happen to the lead, the legacy lead that was in that berm in the past, and whether it could become more mobile. One of the studies in California, it had a significant pH drop of something like 8 originally, and then after shooting the tungsten, it dropped down to 4 or 5, so it was a significant drop.
Go
ahead.
The answer to the second question, which was, is the military still using the round? The answer is yes, and the reason for that is that we just now are starting this field scale study and really don't know the answer to the question. And so we really have a very short fuse, no pun intended there, to get this work done to answer the question.
So stay tuned, I guess, is the answer. Here's a question from Steve Bell Richard with IAAP out of Middleton, Iowa. It says, if WADS may be a source of lead residue, how are these wastes managed, and is there guidance on this?
Most of what I've seen, WADS ultimately recovered and sent off for disposal in landfills as a solid waste. However, I know also that a number of times the state of Massachusetts, for instance, the Secretary of Environmental Affairs in the past had suggested to the industry to look into setting up some kind of program to recover and recycle those plastic wads. Again, they're high-density polyethylene, I believe, or polyethylene at least. And it's a recyclable plastic, and if it could be used in the manufacture of new wads, it would make recovery and recycling much easier. Obviously, you don't want to take that material and put it into a normal plastic recycling stream. You don't want those plastics being used to make new milk jugs, for instance.
Okay, let's go back to our phone line audience. Is there a question for the instructors? Okay, hearing none at this point, we'll move on to some simulcast questions. This one is from John Litzak with the New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services. It says, what do you recommend to site workers to manage wads that have lead residue? Gloves, hands, or how should they be disposed of? Would this be something that would go to a solid waste line landfill?
I think I just covered some of that, but clearly health and safety practices a lot of times it's the range worker, especially someone doing some recovery and recycling or pickup at a range, probably has some of the greatest exposure potential at a range. And appropriate safeguards such as gloves or in some cases even dust masks to minimize the exposure to the worker on the range would make a lot of sense. Some of the work that we've funded in Massachusetts at some ranges looking at recovery and recycling options. We've had the workers fully dressed out in Tyvek suits, et cetera, to minimize the exposure.
Here's a question from Roberta Baca with U.S. Forest Service out of Washington, D.C. Are there resources available to small not-for-profits to prepare environmental management plans? Anybody have any experience with that in their state or federal agencies?
I know in Massachusetts we worked with our division of Fish and Game to see if some of the Pittman Robinson money, PR money, which is a tax on the sale of arms and ammunition, whether some of that could be used for upgrading ranges. And there was a grant program established to allow some ranges to do improvements, but the improvements were from stewardship plans that they had already had already developed, so it wasn't really money to develop the plan, it was money to implement some of the programs within the plan.
Again, that might be a good one for Rick Patterson, and if we can get the email sent in, we can get that to Rick. I mean, the NRA or NSSF may actually have something that could help there.
Okay, we do need to go ahead and wrap up today's training session as we are just about to run out of time. I know there's several simulcast questions we weren't able to get to, but I will be sending those to the instructors for their follow-up by email. So thank you very much to the instructors. We very much appreciate for you being volunteer instructors for the ITRC Small Arms Firing Range team, and thanks to the participants for taking time out of your schedules. We do plan to offer this course again later in the year, so if you have colleagues that would like to participate in this, please encourage them to check the ITRC website as we will typically open registration about 4 to 6 weeks in advance. Right now it is scheduled for about mid-December. So thanks again, everybody. Have a great day, and we hope you will participate on a future ITRC training event.